So welcome, everybody. This is our second in our series for Pestola 2024 podcast, and I'm Dr. Jules Steelman. I'm very pleased today to be joined by Dr. Allison Boyce, who's going to be sharing her experience with us in the upcoming meeting in April. Dr. Boyce is at the NIH, and I'll give her a moment here to introduce herself, but she is recognized as one of the national and international experts in fibrous dysplasia and McCune-Albright syndrome. So thank you very much for joining us today, and tell us a little bit about yourself, Dr. Boyce.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Steelman. It's really my pleasure to be here. So I'm a pediatric endocrinologist. I work at the National Institutes of Health. So we have a large clinical and research program that's focused on pediatric bone disorders, but we have a special interest in fibrous dysplasia. So we have a really kind of probably the world's largest group of kids with fibrous dysplasia, McCune-Albright syndrome that we take care of there.
And how long have you been at the NIH?
Oh, off and on for about 15 years now. You know, I initially came here. Yeah, I joined for my fellowship training and really wasn't expecting to fall in love with research as much as I did. So I really enjoyed my work on bone disorders when I was a fellow. And then I left and was in clinical practice at Children's National for a couple years. And then I've been back at NIH for, I guess, probably about 8 years now. I still will sometimes go and do a small clinic at Children's National, though, because I think it's really nice to be able to have a foot in a couple institutions.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about what your activities are. What are your clinical care activities you do on a routine basis, and a little bit about the research that you're doing these days?
Yeah, so our research at NIH is really grounded in a large natural history study of fibrous dysplasia, McCune-Albright syndrome. Mm-hmm. So on that study, we bring patients from all over the world to the NIH Clinical Center, and we put them through a very standard set of tests to try to understand the clinical phenotype, to really understand what's going on with their skeletal system, their endocrine systems. And then we use that data to go back retrospectively and, identify problems in FDMAS and hopefully find new treatments. So we're not actually doing anything experimental to the patients on that study. We're just seeing them clinically. But the research aspect is that we're collecting the data in a really high quality way. So that's really the basis of everything we do. That study protocol has been going on for about 25 years now. I'm actually the third person to take it on. And then, of course, the overarching goal is to find new treatments. So as part of the observations we make on the natural history study, we kind of take that research into the lab, and we also use that to develop new interventional studies. So we have been recently conducting three different interventional drug trials, one an adult study with denosumab, another pediatric study with denosumab, and then most recently, a mixed study of adults and kids with burosumab.
Interesting. So it sounds like, and from your standpoint, is your role primarily as the clinician, or do you actually get into the lab and do basic research?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. You know, I have a fairly large, really excellent group of about, 15 folks on my team that are implementing a lot of the work. I spend a lot of time seeing patients. You know, I see each patient that comes for all of the studies. And that's, so I would say I probably spend a good, depending on the week, 20 or so hours on direct clinical care, just interpreting labs, seeing patients, looking at studies, which has sort of a dual clinical and research role. And then the rest of the time is really more direct research activities. We do have a wet lab where we have a mouse model of fibrous dysplasia, and we also are doing research using some of the bone tissues in the clinical samples from our protocol. I personally don't have great hands in the lab, but I have some really great people that are carrying out the experiments. So my role is mostly to kind of help drive and direct the research and help interpret the data on that side.
That's great. I mean, it's wonderful to have a really unified and well-functioning team. So it sounds like, again, that's a great asset for you. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what you feel like are maybe two or three key things that have really come to light in our knowledge of fibrous dysplasia over the last, say, 10 years?
Yeah, I would say one aspect that really has driven a lot of the research we're doing is really recognizing what an age-related phenotype we see in FDMAS. Mm-hmm. So it's FDMAS is mosaic. The mutation that causes these bone and endocrine lesions happens in utero. So babies are born, they already have the mutation present. But they typically don't have obvious bone lesions at birth. It's really interesting. The lesions really start showing up in the first few years of life, and then they expand and progress throughout childhood before reaching the final disease burden in adulthood. So it's really changed our concept of how we think of fibrous dysplasia, because it's mm-hmm. it's a progressive disorder of childhood, but it's a static disorder in adulthood. So I think that really drives both how you approach treating it and particularly studying it. You know, that realization has really motivated me to try to find treatments that will stop FD lesion progression in kids. I think this is one disease where really focusing on the kids, trying to stop the lesions before they start, is really the biggest ticket item that I hope we're able to achieve someday.
Absolutely.
And probably the second realization that has really helped drive care is the realization that the endocrinopathies have such a strong impact on the bone phenotype. Mm-hmm. I think the more classical thinking in FDMAS is the orthopedist took care of the bones and the endocrinologist took care of the endocrine features. But now we understand it's quite a bit more integrated. Every time we look at our natural history group and we try to identify what are the risk factors for any bone problem you can think of, fractures, deformities, pain, there's always an endocrinopathy that increases the risk of that. So the hyperthyroidism, the growth hormone excess, hypophosphatemia. So I think it makes our role as endocrinologists even more important because we're trying to prevent a lot of these problems.
And, you know, just to take a detour before I, because I did want to ask you about the endocrinopathies, but just in general, is it your viewpoint or your experience that it's primarily pediatric endocrinologists that are the people that are dealing with FD and McCune-Albright syndrome? I mean, are there geneticists or other specialties that are more of the forefront or the point person?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think in a disease that's this multi-systemic and complex, you really need a team leader to help tie all these different features together. Mm-hmm. I personally do think the pediatric endocrinologist is the best suited for that. You know, mm-hmm. we can manage the endocrine conditions, which are really a central part of the phenotype. And then for the bone lesions, we can help direct and make sure that the patients are getting the appropriate kind of care and monitoring that they need. So part of the visit is dedicated to making sure that they have seen the appropriate specialists. You followed up with your orthopedist about your legs. You know, you had your vision checked this year. You had your hearing checked this year. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a role that can be filled by other specialists. I have seen geneticists fill that role. Sometimes I've seen a really good general pediatrician fill that role. But I really think that one unique thing about endocrine is that it does have this aspect where we really understand bone metabolism and can think of the bone as both structural and metabolic. I think we're really well suited to drive the bus for care for patients with FDMAS.
Well said. I agree with you on that. One thing I'm going to get to endocrinopathies here in a few minutes, but you know what you're saying is really inspiring. So I'm curious too if you had maybe again two or three tips, because one of the challenges oftentimes is, you know, doing a proper workup and making a diagnosis. So what would you advise as far as maybe anywhere from two to three key things that someone confronted, be they, you know, a primary care physician or certainly, you know, pediatric endocrinology, as far as beginning to make the diagnosis and you know, detecting the various endocrinopathies?
Yeah, you know, I think one real takeaway I try to make sure get that you know, clinicians understand is that when you see a patient with either known or suspected FDMAS, there's really two parts to care. The first part is the screening. You want to look head to toe very thoroughly to see where establish where do we have disease and where we don't. By age five, you can pretty much tell with reasonable confidence what the major features are going to be. Mm-hmm. So at age five or greater, we look very carefully. We do a bone scan to identify any areas of FD. We look for laboratory screening for endocrinopathies and ultrasounds. And I think sometimes there's a tendency in an effort to be more cost conscious to just kind of wait and observe and see if any problems arise in that area. But I think in FDMAS, because we do know this age-related phenotype so well, and we do know that the bones are so sensitive to the endocrinopathies, mm-hmm. a full staging evaluation at least once by age five or greater is really important. And then after that, you do shift more into a monitoring mode. One other key point I try to get across is that a lot of the endocrinopathies that happen in MAS happen in other disorders too. So a lot of us are very used to managing hyperthyroidism or precocious puberty. But I think in the kids with MAS, some of the signs that we look for in other kids may not be as applicable. In particular, I'm thinking about growth. I've seen so many cases of kids with growth hormone excess, which is really one of the endocrinopathies that can exacerbate the bone lesions the most, mm-hmm. get missed for years and years because they're just growing at a completely normal rate. This is one of those instances where, growth might be complicated because they have bone disease. So the regular growth chart might not be appropriate. And B, the growth hormone excess might be subtle enough that it's not causing growth acceleration, but the IGF-1 is elevated and it is starting to drive higher lesion activity. So mm-hmm. I do think as for monitoring purposes, kind of a key set of endocrine labs that you check every year, at least while kids are young, to make sure that we pick up any problems early before waiting to see if a clinical problem develops mm-hmm. is pretty important.
Mm-hmm. And just for my own knowledge too, I mean, for me, there's such a breadth and scope when it comes to, all the different endocrine areas. So one of the things I like to do is go back and look at guidelines. And I know that you all have some very good guidance that you've published in over the past mm-hmm. years. But as far as growth hormone excess, besides obviously looking for clinical features, be it, overgrowth or accelerated growth or sweating mm-hmm. or other things, is there anything, do you feel like an IGF-1 or an IGF-BP3 is the best way to do that? Or does it really require you to do growth hormone suppression testing with, glucose loads?
I think for most kids, an IGF-1 is perfectly good place to start. Mm-hmm. The longer I do this, the more it's really been clear to me that there's a subset of kids that it doesn't quite catch. Mm-hmm. So I've seen a few cases where kids have come in with really severe craniofacial FD. Maybe they've had vision loss, large areas of overgrowth, normal IGF-1, and then I'll check a glucose tolerance test and it's completely abnormal. And there seems to be a big discrepancy between the IGF-1 and the growth hormone levels. So I think that's particularly the case in some of the kids that are more malnourished or maybe have some of the other risk factors that can artificially drive down IGF-1.
Okay.
So kind of practice right now, and I think what's probably going to show up in our next set of FDMAS guidelines that hopefully will be available within the next couple of years is that I do use IGF-1 for screening, but if kids are having an unusual progression of their craniofacial FD, if their asymmetry is really progressing quite a bit, or if they develop any vision or hearing problems, mm-hmm. I'll go ahead and check an OGTT just to be on the safe side. Because you really wouldn't want to miss the opportunity to intervene there.
Okay. That's very helpful. One thing I did want to ask you about specifically, this is something that always, when I see young kids, kind of scares me and I always worry about this is Cushing's syndrome. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about, the challenges, especially in the young children with detecting Cushing's syndrome and your experiences in that area?
Yeah, no, it scares me as well.
Yeah.
So the good news about Cushing's syndrome and MAS is it really seems to be, for the most part, a neonatal phenomenon. Mm-hmm. The part of the adrenal gland that overproduces cortisol is the fetal adrenal, which normally involutes. but an MAS will persist. So you shouldn't see new onset Cushing syndrome after the age of one, certainly not after the age of two. What can be tricky, though, is the clinical signs of Cushing syndrome in an infant are very difficult to detect. They're not always the same as in the older kids. Sometimes you'll see weight gain and kind of the increasing facial fullness, but not always. Sometimes it's just poor weight gain. Sometimes it's kids getting a lot of infections, you know, being hospitalized for RSV and other various things. One clue can be they're often born small. They're born small for gestational age. I have a higher level of suspicion, but it's really difficult because it's not easy to get, for example, a 24-hour urine in a baby. So typically, in order to work those kids up, we do admit them. I have a bunch of kids where I'm almost sure they had Cushing's as babies, but it was never diagnosed. They just say, oh, yeah, he was sick all the time as a baby and he was hairy. And then it just kind of went away. About a third of the time, it will spontaneously resolve in MAS. So sometimes you never actually do get to that diagnosis.
That's interesting. So looking at the time here, I want to be respectful of your time and always trying to do little bite-sized little sound bites. So we'll obviously have a chance to hear a lot more from you at your lecture. But is there anything that you would add at this point, things that you're hopeful for future advances in FD-MAS or other pearls that you think that the pediatric community should really think about?
Oh, I'm very hopeful for a treatment. You know, it was really one of the reasons I went into the bone field is, as a fellow. It was so inspiring to see these really incredible new treatments that have been coming down the pike in bone disorders. You know, we have asphatase alpha for hypophosphatemia. Burosumab has been an absolute game changer for X-linked hypophosphatemia. We have treatments coming down the pike for FOP. It's really such an exciting time to be in bone. Sometimes it's a little frustrating. So where is FD's treatment? You know, so there's nothing immediately on the horizon, but I do have hope that we will have a real targeted targeted therapy coming. Hopefully before I retire. That's my real goal. And I think it's another example of why it's so important to focus on pediatric research. You know, these rare diseases have really broad phenotypes. They affect adults, you know, obviously just as often as they affect kids. And there can be a temptation, I think, to study things in adults and focus on the larger adult market. So I try really hard in the FD field to make sure that I'm representing the needs of the children, particularly the fact that this is a progressive disorder of childhood. And there are real opportunities to treat kids that we don't have in adults. So really kind of getting that message out, how important including kids in research is.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with you on that too, as far as both your point on some of the exciting advances that are coming in pediatric bone conditions like FOP. And the other thing too, I think, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, but I think, you know, being a pediatric specialist, it gives us a rare opportunity because things like, you know, the burden of FD on the quality of life and function is something, if we can modify, you know, identify, modify, treat as we can, those are going to have such, you know, profound impacts on the quality of life because, you know, we have all of these, you know, pediatric individuals that, you know, are now, you know, progressing on to adulthood. Many of them, you know, were pretty profoundly impacted, you know, decades ago. And so it really gives us an opportunity, I think, to just, you know, make their quality of life as an adult so much better, you know, than it could have been decades ago.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That's one thing that's particularly exciting when you're a bone specialist, because, I mean, the bones are growing. So, you know, you have an opportunity to try to build the skeleton that they're going to be taking forward into adulthood. And I always tell my patients, you know, one of both the fun of being a pediatrician, but also the burden of being a pediatrician, is that when I look at them, I'm seeing them not only at 5 years, but I'm thinking about them at 10 years, at 20 years, at 60 years, at 100 years. You know, I'm trying to set them up for an entire lifetime of better health. Yeah, it's fun, but it is, you know, it is a complex way of thinking for sure.
Definitely. Well, thank you again for taking time out of your busy schedule to meet with us, and very much looking forward to having you at the Pestola meeting upcoming. And just as we close, just to remind people, you can visit the website at pestola.org to learn a little bit more about our program and sign up to be part of the meeting. So thank you again, Dr. Boyce, and I hope you have a good weekend.
Great. Thanks very much for having me. It was fun. And I really hope to see everyone up at the conference soon.
Thank you.